Praise the Lord, everyone. This is Dr. Michael Morris, again, of For God's Glory Ministries, coming to you with Bible Study on CD. This is Bible Study Session number 118, and we will be covering the Book of the Revelation, chapters 8 and 9. As always, we will first have our quiz, and our quiz will be covering our previous Bible Study Session, which included chapters 6 and 7 of the Book of the Revelation. We have five questions on our quiz. Question number one, this is a multiple choice question. The Christians who the book of the Revelation was written to were enduring persecution by A, Jews, B, Romans, or C, both. The answer is C, both. Question number two. In the first seal, who is the rider on the white horse? The answer is the Antichrist. Question number three. In the fourth seal events, the rider on the red horse represents the violent death of what proportion of the earth's population? Is it A, one-third, B, one-quarter or one-fourth, or C, one-half? The answer is B, one-fourth. Question number four, another multiple choice. The falling stars that John mentions are actually A, black holes, B, comets, or C, meteors? The answer is C, meteors. When they hit the earth, they're called meteorites. Question number five, our final question. How many of God's people will be sealed before the seventh seal events can occur? The answer is 144,000. Alrighty, I hope you did great on the quiz, and we'll get right into our study of the Book of the Revelation, chapter 8. Now, before we begin our studies of chapter 8, I want to make a couple points about comments that I made in our previous session. First of all, I mentioned that chapter 6 provided in those first six seals a general sketch of the times from the Antichrist emerging to the end of the world. Well, there are many Bible scholars that hold that very view, but I would like to point out that there are also many who feel that those events were indeed actual events that will occur with the first six seals, and that the seventh seal events are in addition to the first six seal events. And one thing that does point to that in that direction is the fact that the great men of the earth at the end of chapter 6 say to the mountains, fall on us to hide from our face him that sitteth on the throne and from the wrath of the Lamb. And in verse 17, the final verse, it says, for the great day of his wrath is come, and who shall be able to stand? And so it appears they clearly are still there. They're aware of the judgment, and it appears that they know that more will come. And so that does lend credence to the idea that these events of the sixth seal, even though they're similar to events that we're going to read about upcoming, it is very possible that these events in these first six are just the beginning. Again, as I mentioned before, some do believe, I think, because there's more detail in the trumpets and in the vials, etc., or the bowls, that since there's more detail, there's a belief that this is a general overview with the detail being provided later. I think the most important point to make of this is that this kind of analysis and this kind of divergent views, this is really the norm rather than the exception. Again, as I mentioned at the very beginning of our studying this book, most Bible teachers and preachers ascribe to a given belief, a given scenario for the book of the Revelation, and they present that. They present it as fact. They present it as gospel. And there is the temptation to do that because I do want this to be useful to you. I want it to be interesting to you. I want it to be as coherent as possible for you. And I know that there are many of you out there that are hoping that I would give you a nice, neatly packaged answer to all of those questions that you've had about the book of the Revelation. Well, to that I say this. Remember that your salvation doesn't hinge on this, number one. But number two, whenever there is difficulty, whenever there's struggle, we should take the Bible at its word unless it's very clear that it's symbolic. And number two, we should always look at it from the perspective of those who were the recipients first, whenever there's difficulty, and then pull back and see what significance it has for us today and for us, especially if we are living in the very final days. Alrighty. So I wanted to make that point. The other point relates to the comment that I made about John later in chapter 11 being made aware of an assignment that he will take part of in end times. Well, that's true and it may not be true. The truth of the matter is when we get to chapter 11, we will see where there will be a discussion about two witnesses. And where that comes from is chapter 10. Verse 11, the final verse, where John is told that thou must prophesy again before many peoples and nations and tongues and kings. And this is after he was given the open book from the angel and he was asked to eat that book. And so there's the implication that he has been given words that he's going to tell to people later. However, that's not the only interpretation, and really in that case it comes down to, it pretty much hinges on translation of one specific word. So again, I don't want to get into that yet because we're going to cover that next time when we get to chapter 10, but I just wanted to, in case there were those of you who honed in on what I had to say, I wanted to make that disclaimer that it's not necessarily that John is going to literally himself take part in end time events. We will deal with that issue when we get there, though. Now, as we prepare to study chapter 8, let's just look at exactly where we are. We, first of all, saw in chapter 6 that those persecuted and martyred saints of God were crying out for vengeance for the blood that they had shed. And they were the first group that we see here that received a reward or at least a vision of the reward that they will have. So they were indeed given white robes and they were told to rest a little while, but they received their robes. That's thing number one. The next group that was given a reward or a manifestation or a vision of their reward was given are the 144,000 that will be sealed before the terrible events of the seventh, what is behind the seventh seal in the book of Judgment. So that's the second group that we know are a manifestation or representative of the fidelity of God to his word, of God's character. So those who were martyred clearly will receive their reward. And here we see those who will be here on earth that belong to God, that are his servants, will also receive protection from those terrible things. Now, we will not spend any time right now talking about who those 144,000 folks are. We said we'd touch on that later. But the point here is that this is another group that knows that they're going to be taken care of by God. And then the third group are those in verse 14, where John was asked, who are these? with the white robes. And John said unto the angel, Sir, thou knowest. And he said, These are they which come out of great tribulation and have washed their robes and made them white in the blood of the Lamb. Now, this does not necessarily mean that they were martyred, but this is another group that actually went through tribulation, did not deny the name of Christ despite having been persecuted. And so they also are here shown as getting their reward. And so those who were reading or hearing John's words as they received the words of this prophecy would be very, very encouraged by the fact that those three populations that God was going to take care of, he was going to take care of those who had been martyred for his name. He was going to take care of those that were present on earth during the most calamitous and terrible plagues. And he was going to take care of those who had dealt with persecution, even if it was not unto death, but kept faith in his name and did not deny Christ. So I wanted to point that out as we prepare to look at chapter 8, because that's where we are. We have sealed the 144,000. And so now the angels that were to harm the earth and the people on the earth can now begin their work. And so now I bet you might have thought to yourselves, how can this be the final phase of earth and mankind when we're only on chapter 8? We just finished chapter 7. How can we be at the end when we know that this book contains 22 chapters? Well, the answer to that is that there's a lot that's packed into the book that is revealed by breaking of the seventh seal. There's just a lot in that section. So don't worry. Yes, there are 22 chapters. And yes, we are on the final seal. And so now I'm going to give you a structure behind that seal, because there is a lot there. I'm going to give you a sense of the structure. And it really comes down to the number 7. What you'll find is that end times revelation, it comes in a series of 7s. First of all, we have the 7 seals, 6 of which we've already covered. And this 7th and last seal, which we're about to open, we will find that it has 7 trumpets. And these trumpets herald or bring on tribulation and torment to those on earth. And the 7th trumpet, it reveals 7 signs and wonders in heaven. And then these 7 signs actually depict really the entire story of man in the church up until the end. And now the 7th and final sign is actually 7 angels with the final 7 plagues, which they hold within 7 vials or bowls, or they're sometimes described as cups. Okay, that they will pour out onto the earth, and the manifestation will be the torment of those on earth. And then the 7th and final vial or bowl or cup with its plagues, the final one brings the actual final judgment, the great white throne judgment. And so now back to the 7 trumpets, which we're about to learn about in this session. Now, you'll find a great deal of similarity between the events brought about as the trumpets sound and those events in the first 6 seals. And many, as I mentioned before, would feel that this represents a retelling of the first 6 seal events, but just with more detail. And I know I hinted at that in the previous session. However, one thing strikes me when it comes to this. God goes through a great deal of trouble of making sure that all of his elect on earth are sealed before this seventh seal is broken. Clearly, then, it is much more likely that these events have yet to unfold. And also, there's enough, even though there are similarities, there's enough differences between the trumpets and the seals to lead one to believe that this is a continuation and a furthering of tribulation and torment rather than a retelling of it. Now, many eschatological scholars agree that this quote-unquote great tribulation period at the end of time will actually span just a 7-year period. And I'm mentioning this because many of you may have heard of this sort of stuff, and we're about to dive into a whole lot of events that are really tortuous. And you may begin to ask yourself these questions about timing. And so I thought I would touch on it before we dive into it. But again, this belief system that many ascribe to indicate that this great tribulation period is a 7-year period. And it will be brought on by the emergence of the Antichrist. Understandable. But it is also believed, based on the book of Daniel and his week or year weeks, that there will be a 7-year period, the first 3.5 of which will be peaceful, because the Antichrist will broker a 7-year peace for the Israelis with its neighbors and enemies around them, and therefore essentially bring peace to the world as a result of his ascendancy, likely because of this particular feat. Now, along with that, he will also ingratiate himself to the Jews by commissioning the rebuilding of the Jewish temple and the reinstituting of all of the sacrifices and other functions of the temple. Now, this would be an amazing feat if someone could pull off peace on the one hand and also have the Jews rebuild the temple and institute their traditional worship on the other hand. This would be an amazing guy. Now, by the way, if you want to look at that, the Daniel's a week, you can find that in Daniel chapter 9, right around verse 27 or so. Now, along this same line of reasoning, it is believed that after 3.5 years, again, according to Daniel's prophecies, that this peace treaty will be broken. And it will be broken by the Antichrist going into the temple and declaring himself as God. And biblically speaking, this is considered the abomination of desolation, or also called the abomination that creates desolation or brings about desolation. So again, they conclude on this basis that all of these things in the so-called Great Tribulation period will occur within this 7-year period. And so, following with that reasoning, it is believed that everything from the emergence of the Antichrist on will occur in a 7-year period. Now, this may or may not be the case, but what we do know is that the Antichrist will indeed captivate and rule the entire world for a time. Now, I will tell you one thing, because you haven't read yet what all these terrible things that are going to occur. But I'll say this, that if these things are to occur within a 3.5-year period, it will merely be the grace and the mercy, rather, of God, because it will not be good to be alive in those times. And if it is limited to a 3.5-year period, we will all have, or those who are on earth at that time, will have plenty to be grateful for, because it will only be God's mercy to shorten that time. Okay, so let's begin our study with verse number 1 of chapter 8. And so John writes, "And when he had opened the seventh seal," that is Jesus opening it, "there was silence in heaven about the space of 30 minutes. Now, I find no reason to make more of this than it tells us. Although, while there's little doubt that this silence is unusual and likely significant, it marks the final pause before the tremendous events that are about to occur. But the theories and the presumptions vary so widely among theologians that it is really fruitless for me to get into it too heavily, and it's really anyone's guess is about as good as another. But it is noteworthy, and it certainly was noteworthy by John, that there was silence. I really think it just points to the significance of what's about to come. And then in verse 2, we see that the seven angels were each given a trumpet. Again, all this is building up to these very amazing events to follow. And so next, let's look at verses 3 and 4. And another angel came and stood at the altar, having a golden censer. And there was given unto him much incense, that he should offer it with the prayers of all the saints upon the golden altar which was before the throne. And the smoke of the incense, which came with the prayers of the saints, ascended up before God out of the angel's hand. Now, as you recall from prior chapters, God hears the prayers of the saints. And those who have been and are being persecuted in particular. And here we see the censer, which is a container like a bowl or a wok type of a container that contains live coals, which was used to burn the incense in the temple. And this provided the sweet smelling smoke that represented the prayers of the saints. And in verse 5, we see what happens with those live coals of fire in this case. John writes, and the angel took the censer and filled it with the fire of the altar and cast it into the earth. And there were voices and thunderings and lightnings and an earthquake. So we see that this is now time for the action against God's enemies and the enemies of his people. That is a direct response of their prayers. That's what this symbolizes. That's why the censer with the incense of their prayers and the fire of it were thrown down onto the earth. This is an answer to the prayers of the saints who've been tormented. And so next, in verse 6, the angels prepare to blow their trumpets and to set in motion the full response to the evil of man and the answer to the prayers of the fallen, tormented, and martyred saints. And so in verse 7, we have the first trumpet blown. The first angel sounded, and there followed hail and fire mingled with blood, and they were cast upon the earth, and the third part of trees was burned up, and all green grass was burned up. Now, first of all, I believe that this happening upon this first trumpet was what was described earlier in verse 5, talking, or actually maybe it was before that, where the incense and the fire in the censer were dumped onto the earth. I think it's verse 5. This is the cause of the events in verse 7, which we get a better description of, which burns up a third of the trees and all of the green grass. Now, you'll see later that there is green grass again, so it does regrow, but for some time, however long that is, there is no green grass, if we're to read this literally. Now, I'm sure that you can imagine the environmental, agricultural, and economic impact of this event. Don't think that God is doing this to judge or to harm the natural world. That is not what God's intention is. The earth is certainly being judged because of its sin, but it's man that has sinned. What is really happening here is the secondary events or impacts that will occur as a result of this is what will really cause man to suffer. But it doesn't stop there, because in verses 8 and 9, we see, "And the second angel sounded, and as it were a great mountain burning with fire was cast into the sea, and the third part of the sea became blood. And the third part of the creatures which were in the sea and had life died, and a third part of the ships were destroyed." Now, in the natural, I can see that if a great chunk or mass of earth were scorched enough, there could be an instability in the root structure and in the underlying structure that could allow a portion of land to fall over into the sea, as it were. But that's less important at this point. What most agree is that verse 8 doesn't mean a literal mountain, if you will, but they all agree that it doesn't matter. The end result is what it is, and as we see this second direct assault on nature and its indirect impact on man will be staggering. Now, the one-third of the sea creatures and ships represents for us that nothing will be spared, not so much to mean the exact one-third will be destroyed, and if that occurs, so be it. But the biggest point there is simply that nothing will be spared in that regard. The animals or the sea creatures will not be spared, nor will ships, so that we didn't think that it was just a mere contamination of the water at this point. Now, this water turned to blood is reminiscent of the plagues of Egypt as well. Also notice that there will be a theme that you'll see here of one-thirds in this destruction associated with these trumpet punishments. So these judgments are partial in nature, but it will lead up to one final and permanent judgment. And still, these cataclysmic events just keep on coming as God and his people are granted justice. So next, let's look at verses 10 and 11. "And the third angel sounded, and there fell a great star from heaven, burning as it were a lamp. And it fell upon a third part of the rivers and upon the fountains of waters. And the name of the star is called Wormwood. And the third part of the waters became wormwood. And many men died of the waters because they were made bitter." Now, one thing I want you to notice, there is a distinction here. The mountain or the mountain-like structure fell into the ocean or the sea. Very, very important. And so the ones that suffered were, number one, those that are in the ships or in the ocean for some reason, and the ocean creatures. But this time there is a different body of water that will be affected. Now, first of all, this will be a large meteorite that will strike the earth. And as expected, it will light up the sky as a fireball as it comes through the Earth's atmosphere. Now, this will be a common event in the end times, as you will recall from the sixth seal. But the multiple meteors of the sixth seal had to be small for the Earth to survive. There's no way that they could have been large and come in multiple and the Earth to actually survive it. But this particular one is a single, much larger meteor. But notice that unlike what we normally think of as a meteor and a meteor's damage, this is not due to the direct impact of the meteor, but rather its contents, what it's made of, and what it does to the water. Because it will make one-third of the Earth's water contaminated and useless. And notice that this is a focus on freshwater sources, okay, like rivers and streams and lakes. This is not a contamination of the oceans, which are not a source of drinking water anyway, because they're salted. So this is a different kind of a thing. This actually will impact man in a different way. The first one, obviously, if the ocean is made into blood, that's not good. We don't have the sea. One-third of the sea creatures that we might partake of as food are not available to us. There's all sorts of ramifications of that, in addition to the folks who happen to be in the water at the time who will perish. But here is literally a contamination of the drinking water. Now, to that point about wormwood, wormwood is a bitter plant that is common to the Middle East. And the term wormwood is often used in analogy to speak of bitterness and sorrow. So imagine the further impact this would have to life on Earth. This will look nothing like the peaceful existence that the Antichrist will usher in and will promise to maintain. No, his promises will not be kept, and the earth will not be a good place to be. Now, in my studies and research, there's some debate as to whether wormwood is poisonous. Some places I see it truly is. They say it's poisonous to humans, and then other places they say it's bitter but not poisonous. But there's no debate as to its bitterness. Now, here in verse 11, John says that many died of the waters because they were made bitter. Now, this is possibly death due to dehydration because it was too bitter for them to take, to drink. Or maybe it could also be that there's a poisonous effect. But either way, the same result occurs. The waters mentioned come from both, being fresh water, they come from both rain and from runoff from the melting snowpacks in the mountains, like our Colorado Rockies. So anything that taints those two sources would harm large populations. And for our California area, and really all of the Southwest, anything that harms the Rocky Mountains and or the Colorado River would taint nearly all of the drinking water that we depend on. It would likely also damage any food that is grown from the water, that if it's used as irrigation. And so the assault on nature is direct here, but man is indirectly being impacted tremendously as we march on through these trumpets. Now, let me point out for you one scenario where this could really occur, because I want, wherever it is appropriate and possible, to take some of the science fiction type nature off of these scriptures. On the west coast of the United States, largely along California, in the northern middle to northern California, up near our Sacramento area, there is a fair amount of land that actually is protected through levees, and they've built homes there and big buildings, etc. And those levees are definitely thought to be inadequate, especially if we were to have some big storm. And so, if indeed a meteor were to fall and hit, say, in the ocean, that ocean water, that would create a wave, a tsunami of sorts, if you will, or it certainly would create a wave enough to break those levees and to cause that ocean water, that seawater, that salt water to go into this area, which is a fairly low altitude. And so ultimately, what would happen is this salt water would go move inland and eventually connect with the fresh water sources that we use as our potable drinking water. And so this is one way where we literally would get to the point where we would lose all or nearly all of our drinking water source in Southern California. Now, obviously, this is going to create a problem with a third of all of the water. So it's not likely going to be just here on the west coast of California, But I'm just giving you this as an example of what can happen in a natural way, in a realistic way, that would match up with what we see here in Scripture. And actually, not to belabor this point too much, but because of the rights to the drinking water and the way that things are written, a fair amount of our water bypasses us and goes down to Mexico, as it is written in the treaties and in the agreements. And so this would affect more than just California or Southern California. It would affect even those in Mexico that depend on that water. And so that brings us to verse 12. And it says, "And the fourth angel sounded, and a third part of the sun was smitten, and a third part of the moon, and a third part of the stars, so as the third part of them was darkened, and the day shone not for a third part of it, and the night likewise." So this amazing astronomical change may seem just like God is flexing his muscles, showing what he can do because he controls the planets. But no, there's much more to it than that. What is happening here is that there will be one third less sunlight and one third less light at night. This would have a significant, devastating impact on our ecosystems and our functioning in general. Our weather will change, our ability to grow crops will diminish, our normal functioning and possibly our circadian rhythms, our sleep patterns will be thrown completely off. Now, can you imagine how these hungry folks are also thirsty, the water supply is messed up, are also going to be cranky because they're not getting the proper sleep because everything's going to be all thrown off. And there's no doubt that there will be some supernatural significance given, some line, some spin that the Antichrist will give. And of course, the people of that time will accept the lie that the Antichrist will give them. And no doubt the scientific community will be searching for some logical explanation based on their knowledge. And so now that's it for the first four trumpets. I think they were pretty devastating. What do you think? And that's not all of it. Man has only been indirectly impacted so far. All of these natural resources and natural phenomena that we've come to take for granted will no longer be taken for granted in these final days. But keep your seatbelts fastened, because as we see in verse 13, the final three trumpets bring with them events so terrible that they're called the three woes. Verse 13 says, "And I beheld and heard an angel flying through the midst of heaven, saying with a loud voice, Woe, woe, woe to the inhabitants of the earth by reason of the other voices of the trumpet of the three angels which are yet to sound." So I think you get the idea. It's really going to be something else when we get to those final three trumpets. But as I study through and look at the various commentators and theologians on this subject matter, there's an inordinate, at least in my view, amount of time spent focusing on whether this is an angel or an eagle that's flying through the midst of the heaven. I think that we can all agree, you know, in one big chorus that it really doesn't matter. The point here is that this angel or eagle is a messenger of God, and he was able to speak in a way that John could understand. And I know that the majority of you who've been studying with me up to this point know that that is what's important. Because, baby, we ain't seen nothing yet is what this angel is trying to tell us, trying to tell them as far as man is concerned. So man will next begin to feel the more direct impact of God's judgment. And so while chapter 8 was indeed a doozy, I think the chapter 9 is really going to bring something amazing. And so you won't have to wait long for that, because we're going to get right into chapter 9 right now. Now, there are two key features to look at as we study these last three trumpets. First of all, a man is affected directly by them, and that is a change. Second of all, the demonic world becomes much more obvious in its involvement. Let's take a look at verse 1. And the fifth angel sounded. And the fifth angel sounded. And I saw a star fall from heaven unto the earth, and to him was given the key of the bottomless pit. Now, looking at verse 1, first of all, there are several ways this can be looked at. The star, of course, is not a star. It's actually, obviously, an angel. Now, the fact that Satan used to be Lucifer gives some people the idea that this is indeed Satan. But clearly, it's an angel. It may be one of either be Satan, or it may be one of his key angels, one of his key demon angels. It could also be one of God's angels. The prevailing belief, though, is that it is Satan. And the translation there means to descend, and many say that the most direct translation is a fallen angel. There's a great deal of desire for it to read that way, though, given the fact that most want to believe that that is Satan. And actually, either way, it really doesn't matter. The key thing is that this angel is given the key to the bottomless pit. Now, Jesus possesses the key to the bottomless pit, but he allows it to be released for this time and for this purpose. Now, this bottomless pit or abyss, it's abuso in the Greek. This is the place where evil spirits are imprisoned and held when they have not been given or granted access to the earth. Now, as with Satan, their leader, they can only go as far as God allows. Now, this is definitely not a good place to be. This is actually the place where back in the book of Luke, chapter 8, where Jesus cast the demons, the legion of demons, out of the Gadarene man and into the pigs. And the pigs did not want him to send them into the abyss. This is exactly the place they did not want to be sent to. So now this place, this abyss, this is not hell, but everyone that is there is destined for hell. So now in the upcoming verses, we will see the direct impact of these demonic forces being given more freedom than they have ever had before since they were kicked out of heaven. So let's look at verses 2 and 3. And he opened the bottomless pit, and there arose a smoke out of the pit, as the smoke of a great furnace. And the sun and the air were darkened by reason of the smoke of the pit. And there came out of the smoke locusts upon the earth. And unto them was given power, as the scorpions of the earth have power. So this bottomless pit is opened by the angel that was given the key, and smoke comes out of it. Now that's probably no shocker that smoke would come out. But in addition to the smoke, locusts come out. And that's probably more of a surprise. You might not be shocked that there may be locusts, but you're probably a little surprised that they came out of this bottomless pit. Now first I want you to note where they come from. Realize these locusts didn't just come out of the earth. They came out of the pit. So now as you realize where they come from, it won't be as difficult for you to understand and believe the other characteristics that distinguish them from regular locusts. Now, your regular locusts are a type of grasshopper. And by their very nature, at a point in their life cycle, they swarm. And they're vegetarians. And so they have devastated crops off and on throughout man's history. But these are not your everyday locusts. Normal locusts, for instance, are only harmful to plant life, as I mentioned before, which is what they eat. But these locusts are actually demons in the form of locusts. They are driven to harm man, which was their intent, their purpose. So this is why they have the unusual power to sting and to harm people like scorpions. This also explains their odd appearance, as John will soon reveal. Actually, half of this chapter is devoted to this fifth trumpet, which is also the first woe. And the bulk of it focuses on the key characteristics of these locust demons. So we'll be learning much more about these locust demons from verses 4 through 11. And next, verse 4. And it was commanded them that they should not hurt the grass of the earth, neither any green thing, neither any tree, but only those men which have not the seal of God in their foreheads. Now, I was going to mention this earlier when we were looking at a previous section, and it said that a third of the trees, etc., and the sea, and all of the green grass. As you can see here, that there's still some grass available, and it's very possible that they were talking about shrubs, shrubbery in general. It's hard to know. I think the point here is that greenery is affected, and I think it's there's something that must be lost in translation as to the exact green plants that were impacted, because there would be none left here for the locusts to harm if it was completely gone. There's also the possibility that in the intervening time, some green grass may have grown in, and so that's also a possible explanation. So here we see that, as always, we are reminded that demonic forces have limitations, and they must remain within those boundaries that they're given. And here, the very thing that normal locusts usually would attack or eat are actually forbidden of these locusts. They're instructed to use their unique scorpion-like stinging ability to hurt those that are on the earth, at least those that do not have God's seal on their foreheads. Now, remember back before the seventh seal was revealed or was open, and God stopped the action for a time so that he could seal his 144,000 and therefore protect them. Now, one thing that this does tell us about the chronology of these events is that these events do indeed have to have come after the sixth seal. And even though in many ways it appears that the first six seals could be an overview and the trumpets, bowls, etc. provide more detail of that from that overview, we see here that clearly, at least in part, it comes after the six seals. Clearly we see this portion has to have come after the sixth seal, and thus in addition to the events revealed in general terms in the first six of the seven seals. Now it also lets us know that the 144,000 are still on earth, which is why they required the protection in the first place. So we don't have a problem of potentially confusing them with saints that are in heaven or that have received their white robes already, because clearly this 144,000 are still on earth. So we're going to watch this 144,000 as we study through and look at who they are, what they do, and any other characteristics about them. All right, let's look at verse 5. And to them it was given that they should not kill them, but that they should be tormented 5 months. And their torment was as the torment of a scorpion when he striketh a man. Now, I've seen this looked at two different ways, and I'm sure you can imagine. Either these locusts would be allowed or will be allowed to do their thing, their torment to men for 5 months. Or it's also possible that the torturous discomfort from a sting from one of these locusts would last for 5 months from just one sting. Fortunately, it really doesn't matter. And the key point is, number one, that they will not be allowed to kill them. They will only be allowed to torment them. And also the fact that this torment lasts 5 months, regardless of how it lasts 5 months, that is a long time. That's somebody that you really want to feel the pain, as opposed to giving them a swift death. So we also know that this torment will be quite tremendous based on verse 6, where John writes, "And in those days shall men seek death and shall not find it, and shall desire to die, and death shall flee from them." So it's very clear how bad these stings will be, because people will literally wish death upon themselves. Now, John devotes verses 7 through 11 to the description of these locust demons, which obviously made quite an impression on him, and he took quite a bit of effort in their description. So let's look at verses 7 through 11 and see how John describes these locust demons. "And the shapes of these of the locusts were like unto horses prepared unto battle, and on their heads were as it were crowns like gold, and their faces were as the faces of men, and they had hair as the hair of women, and their teeth were as the teeth of lions, and they had breastplates as it were breastplates of iron. And the sound of their wings was as the sound of chariots of many horses running to battle. And they had tails like unto scorpions, and there were stings in their tails, and their power was to hurt men 5 months. And they had a king over them, which is the angel of the bottomless pit, whose name in the Hebrew tongue is Abaddon, but in the Greek tongue hath his name Apollyon." Now, many Bible expositors have concluded that this is symbolic imagery and John's best effort simply to describe what are really end times weaponry and soldiers. So that's a fairly common explanation for this imagery, is that it is John's best attempt at describing what really is end times weaponry. Now, I think that this is actually the most, the least likely of the explanations, since they do not originate from earth, but from the abyss. So these are not entities that originate from earth like regular army personnel would with their weaponry. These come from the abyss. And also, their leader's name, both in the Hebrew and the Greek tongue, means essentially the same thing. Abaddon means destruction, and Apollyon means destroyer. So this refers either to Satan himself or one of his highest ranking demons. Fortunately, God's sealed people are not going to be harmed by any of this. And so that is the last that John is going to say at all about the first of the three woes. And so next, let's look at verse 12. He says, "One woe is past, and behold, there come two woes more hereafter. And thus it's time for the sixth angel to sound the sixth trumpet, introducing the second woe." The next couple of verses say, "And the sixth angel sounded, and I heard a voice from the four horns of the golden altar, which is before God, saying to the sixth angel, which had the trumpet, loose the four angels, which are bound in the great river Euphrates." Now, first of all, the horns of the altar are actually just protruding metal portions of the altar at each corner. They're actually used to tie the legs, the four legs of the sacrificial animal to the altar so that it can be burned as a sacrifice. Now, as far as the four angels are concerned, many believe that these angels are evil angels or fallen angels, especially since they've been bound all of this time, and also that they are charged with direct destruction. Now, just as with the locust demons, Satan and his followers are allowed greater activity at this point in order for God's judgment to be meted out on earth. Now, as for the Euphrates River, this has great significance in the Bible, and it still is the longest, largest, and most important river in Western Asia. Babylon, or actually what is modern-day Iraq, was the most important of the many ancient cities along its path, and that is still true today. So these angels have been bound there, awaiting this time for this specific purpose. Now, verse 15, and the four angels were loosed, which were prepared for an hour and a day and a month and a year, for to slay the third part of men. Now, believe it or not, or you probably believe it at this point, there's a fair amount of debate over whether this verse points to a moment in time or a period of time for these angels' activities. Well, you know, not that it really matters a great deal, but I'm in the camp that says that it points to a moment in time. I believe that they were loosed at this point in time for a specific purpose. But either way, their sole purpose is to effect the violent death of one third of mankind through war. Earlier, we saw that one quarter of mankind was killed under one of the seals. After this, essentially one fourth plus one third of what's left, basically half of all of mankind will have been killed as a result of the events associated with these seals. The first time it was the rider on the pale horse in the fourth seal. And of course, this time it's in association with the seventh seal and the sixth trumpet. Now, we're going to begin to look at what these angels will actually do. Now, in the next several verses, John will describe this great destructive army that's assembled by these angels, these four destroying angels. And in verse 16, he focuses on the number of them. He says, and the number of the army of the horsemen were 200,000,000. And I heard the number of them. Now, if taken literally, this comes to 200 million soldiers. Now, in John's day, this would have seemed an unimaginable number of soldiers. But today, actually, there are countries and certainly alliances that could easily put this many soldiers in the battlefield. For instance, between the three countries of China, India, and Japan in Asia, for instance, they could assemble such an army right now, today. Now, putting the number behind us, we turn to John's description. We find that in verses 17 through 19. And so he writes, and thus I saw the horses in the vision, and them that sat on them, having breastplates of fire, and of jacinth, and brimstone, and the heads of the horses were as the heads of lions, and out of their mouths issued fire and smoke and brimstone. By these three were the third part of men killed, by the fire and by the smoke and by the brimstone which issued out of their mouths. For their power is in their mouth and in their tails, for their tails were like unto serpents and had heads, and with them they do hurt. Now, with such an outlandish sounding description for this army, both the fighters and their horses, it actually leaves us with but two choices for interpretation. One is the interpretation of these horses and horsemen as demonic or demon-possessed, or at least demon-directed. And some symbolism here is therefore implied. One thing that we can be confident of is that horses will not likely be the mode of transport for any future fighting force. So clearly some symbolism is implied. Whatever these things are that are used, they clearly don't look like anything normal. Certainly no normal horses or no normal animal, no normal people. Secondly, the second possibility is that even though we know that the impetus behind this fighting force is indeed demonic, the description is just John's best description of 21st century or later battlefield equipment or armory. But with all of this being possible, I believe that given the context of these last couple of woes and the explicit demonic forces behind them, I think that the best explanation as to why the description is so outlandish is because of the very clearly demonic nature of the fighting force being put together specifically by these four angels who had been held up to this time for this purpose in this moment. But after all of this, the second woe is still not over. And we won't complete that until halfway through chapter 11. So this second woe is really going to be something. And so as for the final verses in chapter 9, we'll go ahead and read those. And the rest of the men which were not killed by these plagues, yet repented not of the works of their hands, that they should not worship devils and idols of gold and silver and brass and stone and of wood, which neither can see nor hear nor walk. Neither repented they of their murders, nor of their sorceries, nor of their fornication, nor of their thefts. And so the key thing here is really twofold. One, despite all of this, man's heart is so corrupted that he will not see the error of his ways and repent with all this going on. And secondly, these sins that are mentioned here are not intended to be a list, but they're essentially hinting at the Ten Commandments, talking about the various things that man has been entrenched with that goes against God, that he repeatedly does, and that he is not looking at all of this horrific calamity as a warning for him to change his ways. And so now we've gotten through part of the visions of the seventh seal. Remember, this is the last seal in the book, and everything that we talk about after this is found behind that seventh seal. So we've covered six of the seven trumpets, which are within the or behind the seventh seal, or at least we've started to complete the sixth of the seventh trumpet. We haven't quite finished that sixth one yet, which is the second woe. And of course, we have yet to experience that seventh trumpet and thus the third woe. And the signs and wonders and the bowls or vials or cups and ultimately the final judgment of the seventh bowl. But for now, I think that we've had our fill for one session. Enough blood and gore and death and torment and torture and awful visions and demons and things like that. I think we've had enough for one session. So until next time, this is Dr. Michael Morris feeling very grateful and honored to be bringing this Bible study of the book of the Revelation to you on behalf of For God's Glory Ministries. I still am praying that you're uncovering God's hidden treasure in your lives. Even though we say it over and over again, it's no small thing. It is what you were created for on earth. So hopefully you're doing that. And as always, as you do whatever it is that you do for the Lord, hopefully you will do that for God's glory. See you next time.